And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, several midterm election races are still in play.
California wildfires killed five as they attempted to escape.
And in international news, the Afghan Taliban are in talks in Russia.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 9th, 2018. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Jasmine Moneymaker. Mayor Wheeler's emergency ordinance to restrict Portland protests failed to get a vote at City Hall yesterday afternoon. The mayor quickly substituted a new ordinance, and council voted to at least hear from the assembled stakeholders. As Mayor Wheeler noted in his opening remarks, the divides of our nation are mirrored in this very issue. And indeed, statements by Police Chief Outlaw and Mayor Wheeler on the one hand and the National Lawyers Guild and Joanne Hardesty on the other represent remarkably different perspectives. KBOO's Joe Meyer was at City Hall and filed this report.
Mayor Wheeler's so-called free speech zone ordinance was dead on arrival at City Hall yesterday afternoon. Since everyone was already there, council voted to hear testimony on a revised ordinance. Here's Mayor Wheeler introducing the ordinance.
As mayor, it's expected that I will do everything I can to uphold the public safety. We cannot deny the increasing rate of demonstrations and increasing violence. This ordinance seeks to remove violence from demonstrations and preserve the public's right to express speech meaningfully. This ordinance enacts reasonable, content-neutral, time, place, and manner regulations for demonstrations held in the city with the goals of protecting both freedom of expression for demonstrators and the safety of the entire community.
The invited speakers on the yes side included Police Chief Danielle Outlaw.
I've seen some narrative out there flat out stating that Chief Outlaw just wants more power. This is not about me. Me taking this job was not about me. Violent protests are not solely a Chief Outlaw concern or a Mayor Wheeler or Police Commissioner Wheeler concern. In fact, violent clashes between demonstrators in Portland have existed long before the two of us took positions here in Portland. However, once these groups of people who have engaged in past violence come together, we don't know when and where they will engage in fights or assaultive behavior. It can be during a march, in the middle of a large crowd, or occur at a place where police cannot readily or easily respond. In addition, there can be challenges in responding to these acts of violence, as it takes a tremendous amount of resources to safely make arrests and control violent crowds.
Those were voices of Mayor Wheeler and Chief Outlaw. Their arguments start with danger and fear and conclude with more police power to preemptively protect property and the Portland brand. On the no side of Wheeler's free speech zone ordinance, Kimberly McCullough of the ACLU was the first to testify.
We have deep concerns about the this ordinance being presented as a solution to the challenges we face. And because we have such deep concerns, we urge you to change course and not adopt it. We believe it will lead us down a path of rights violations and costly litigation. As to our specific concerns, we have constitutional concerns and concerns as a matter of policy. At the outset, we are hard-pressed to see how this will actually prevent violence from occurring or reduce the use of law enforcement resources and police enforcement. It's also hard to understand how the ordinance that gives government additional authority to enforce new rules is somehow going to lead to reduced enforcement. It really is just creating another avenue for enforcement. We understand that the city's attorney's office believes the ordinance is constitutional, but we respectfully disagree. The problem is we can't just say that reasonable, content-neutral, time, place, and manner regulations are constitutional and end our analysis there. With these kinds of regulations, the devil is in the details, and those details are incredibly problematic here.
That was Kimberly McCullough of the ACLU. Neutral enforcement of Wheeler's proposed ordinance would be difficult given the problematic history of Portland police prejudice. Beth Ruder of the National Lawyers Guild has experience on the ground at Portland protests and offered a sharper critique of Wheeler's proposal.
We understand the desire to stop right-wing violence brought to our city by Patriot Prayer and the Proud Boys. However, we view this ordinance as exactly what Patriot Prayer wants, an opportunity to enlarge the police state that has repeatedly attacked counter-demonstrators of their rallies. This ordinance does three things. One, it allows the city to arbitrarily place individuals into ill-defined groups. It polices the language of protest to craft what will undoubtedly be overreaching protest restriction. And it enables post hoc justifications for police violence against protesters. Generally, it is true that time, place, manner restrictions are valid exercises of state power per the First Amendment. However, when police are left to enforce these restrictions, counter-demonstrators get hurt. We and so many others have observed this. PPB chooses to send us all they've got. They line up, predominantly facing the counter-demonstrators, and separate the factions. Sometimes with no provocation, the police violently disperse the counter-demonstrators. Most recently on August 4th, counter-demonstrators nearly got killed by police weapons and tactics. We refute many of the factual conclusions made by the ordinance describing these protests. No one but police deploy flashbang grenades, full-strength pepper spray, pepper ball projectiles, and other impact weapons that amount to use of deadly force.
That was Beth Wouter of the National Lawyers Guild. Mayor Wheeler's ordinance is playing into the hands of white nationalists, and the Portland police are the greatest purveyors of street violence. The final invited presenter on the no side was Portland Commissioner-elect Joanne Hardesty.
The police have been a tool of brutalizing people standing up for their civil rights. We are a city known for protests. We are known for making space for people to protest what they want to protest. It is our right as Americans. It is our obligation to stand up against hate. Because if the brave children and men and women had not stood up in the 60s, when people that look like me were just trying to register to vote, trying to get decent housing, trying to get decent education, if we had not stood up, just because that was the law at the time, it was not a just law. I want to encourage you to slow down this ordinance, and let's have some community meetings in January when I join you, so that we can talk to the community about how we keep everybody safe. It's important for you to understand that we don't all experience the police the same way. When white women protest, the police come out with cameras and pussy hats and smiles. When African Americans and other people of color and people with less power protest, they come out in full riot gear.
That was Portland Commissioner-elect Joanne Hardesty. Their personal experience speaks to the impossibility of so-called content-neutral enforcement. And this is Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
Joanne Hardesty, former state legislature and NAACP Portland branch president, was elected Tuesday as the first ever woman of color on Portland City Council. The race was bound to be historic regardless of the victor. In the end, Hardesty won with a 62% of the vote in Multnomah County Commissioner and Multnomah County Commissioner Loretta Smith, 37%. Hardesty's 25% lead echoed the outcome of the spring primary when Hardesty got 46% of the vote to Smith's 21%.
Three fast-moving wildfires are still burning out of control in California, destroying homes and forcing tens of thousands of people to evacuate. Five people died in Northern California when flames engulfed their vehicles as they attempted to flee Paradise, a mountain town north of Sacramento. Many people were forced to abandon their vehicles and run for their lives down the town's sole road. The blaze that broke out on Thursday has more than tripled in size to 70,000 acres and is only 5% contained. Scott McLean of the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, said the town of Paradise had been, quote, devastated. About 2,000 structures were destroyed in the area. Nearly 500 miles to the south, a second fire forced the evacuation of the upscale Oceanside city of Malibu and threatened the beleaguered town of Thousand Oaks, where 12 people were killed this week in a shooting at a bar and dance hall. A third wildfire was also expanding in Southern California's Ventura County. No fatalities have been reported from the two fires in the South. California Acting Governor Gavin Newsom on Friday declared a state of emergency for areas affected by the Woolsey and the Hill fires in Ventura and Los Angeles counties.
2 days after the midterm elections, some important contests are still pending. In a near repeat of the so-called Brooks Brothers riot that helped steal the 2000 presidential election from Al Gore, Republican-backed protesters have descended upon the elections offices in Broward County, Florida, to prevent an effective count of the remaining ballots in the midterm senatorial contest. Both the governor's office and a Senate seat are still in play in Florida. Republicans who are appearing slightly ahead for both seats are watching their margin erode as absentee ballots, which favor Democrats, are slowly counted. Nationally, the president is furiously tweeting in all caps as ballots are counted in populous Palm Beach County, and the Republicans have sued the election supervisor there, fearing a loss. In Georgia, Democrat Stacey Abrams has refused to concede her gubernatorial contest against the Republican candidate Brian Kemp. Kemp is accused by observers of skewing the results of the race as he held the state elections chair even as he was running for governor. Greg Palast, quoted in The Salon, said, quote, "The hidden story here in Georgia is the fight over the provisional ballots, something that didn't even exist until after the election was stolen in Florida in 2000. The provisional ballots are given to you if your name is missing from voter rolls or there is an ID problem or something else that doesn't meet Georgia or any of Mr. Kemp's chutes and ladders requirements to vote. You voted provisionally," end quote. "Now that you fill out the provisional ballot," Palast continued, "it's put in this orange envelope that looks like it's from Biohazard. They decide where that vote will be counted." Palast points out that Kemp never intended to count the provisional ballots, using them instead as a placebo to make people think that they had voted when they effectively had not. "We've already been told," Palast said, "Brian Kemp has laid down the law to all the counties. You are not to count provisional ballots of anyone who has been purged, even if they have been purged wrongly. Now we have, as we know, 340,140 people purged from moving who didn't move." As of earlier today, Arizona's Democratic Representative Kyrsten Sinema was still ahead of Republican Representative Martha McSally by a mere 2,000 votes. In Florida, Republican Governor Rick Scott leads Democrat incumbent Senator Bill Nelson by about 15,000 votes and dropping for the Senate seat, representing Ron DeSantis, a Republican whom the Associated Press declared the winner, is ahead of Democrat Andrew Gillum by about 35,000 votes and dropping in the Florida governor's race. Meanwhile, Republican Brian Kemp is ahead of the Democrat former State House Minority Leader Stacey Abrams by 63,000 votes in the Georgia's governor's race, but Abrams continues to make substantial gains as the purged votes are gradually counted.
And in another election story from Georgia, on Tuesday, voters elected a woman of color who's also a Democrat in the traditionally Republican area once represented by Congressman Newt Gingrich. Lucy McBath is a gun control and racial justice activist. Her run was inspired after her son died in a 2012 shooting. McBath beat the Republican currently holding the job, Karen Handel. Just last year, Handel won a special election for the Georgia district. The AP officially called the race for McBath on Thursday. She had a lead of almost 3,000 votes.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Bread and Roses. Then at 7, The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight's temperature will drop to 40 degrees in the Portland metropolitan area. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a high near 53. Today is the 80th anniversary of Kristallnacht, a pogrom against Jews throughout Nazi Germany on the 9th and 10th of November 1938. It was carried out by Nazi paramilitaries and German civilians. The German police looked on without intervening. The name Kristallnacht comes from the shards of broken glass that littered the streets after the windows of Jewish-owned stores, buildings, and homes and synagogues were smashed. The quote of the day is from Elie Wiesel, who said, quote, We must always take sides. Neutrality helps the oppressor, never the victim. Silence encourages the tormentor, never the tormented.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. An incumbent state representative in Wyoming lost his House seat against Northern Arapaho member Andrea Clifford. Clifford credits much of her win to meeting people in person and creating a strong social media campaign. Melody Edwards has more.
Clifford is the former assistant manager of the Wind River Casino and a former county commissioner. She says 65% of her county is Native American, but they aren't usually empowered to vote, and she worked hard to educate people about where and how to cast their ballot. Clifford says social media was an important tool to do that.
Native people were into social media. It's like our newest, latest technology of the moccasin telegraph. And number one being Facebook. So you'll see a lot of my Facebook posts, what I capitalized on.
Clifford says her slogan, Indigenous Women Strong, resonated powerfully all around Indian country. She says now that she's won, there's a lot of work to do.
We need a Native at the tables in Cheyenne. It's important to have our voice. We're a large land-based tribe, you know, 2.2 million acres. We have a lot of potential for economic development, for collaborating and partnering.
Clifford will be the second Native American woman to serve a statewide office in Wyoming. The first was Senator Affie Ellis, a member of the Navajo tribe. For National Native News, I'm Melody Edwards.
Nine Native Americans were elected to the Montana State Legislature. Nikki Ouellette of Montana Public Radio reports.
Tribal members held nine seats across Montana's House and Senate during the 2017 session. This session, they'll hold 11. While four tribal members ran unopposed for Senate and House seats, in two races, tribal members from different parties ran against each other. Democrat Jonathan Windy Boy of the Chippewa Cree beat out fellow Chippewa Cree Republican Bruce Myers. Tyson Running Wolf, a Blackfeet Democrat, also beat out fellow Blackfeet Republican Kay Webb Galbraith in Tuesday's midterms. 17 Native Americans ran in Montana's primaries, according to Mark Trahant with Indian Country Today. 14 made it to the general election. The Montana Indian Caucus has previously lobbied for Medicaid expansion and tribal water compacts. With eight House members and three senators, Native Americans will make up 7% of the Montana legislature this January. A census estimate for 2017 says American Indians make up 6.7% of Montana's total population. For National Native News, I'm Nikki Ouellette.
In Idaho, Paulette Jordan may have been defeated in her race for governor, but she remains optimistic after voters approved a proposition to expand Medicaid, as Steve Jackson reports.
Paulette Jordan lost by a wide margin, gaining just under 38% of the vote in her bid to be the first female and Native American governor of Idaho. But on election night, she was excited by the prospect that Idaho voters managed to do what Idaho lawmakers have refused to do for several years, expand the Medicaid coverage in the state to cover more people that don't make enough to qualify for subsidies under the Affordable Care Act.
I know that when people see that Medicaid expansion will be a major plus on multiple fronts, from not only health care but mental health and bringing our resources back. They will see that we can expand in those areas where we need to build up on our rural hospitals as an economic engine and expand to rehabilitative health care.
It's estimated that 62,000 Idahoans are in the so-called Medicaid gap, that made too much to qualify for Medicaid and too little to get tax credits under the ACA. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is by Odawi Law Group, provider of Indian Law Solutions, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite System.
Support by the American Indian Higher Education Consortium, 36 culturally based open door colleges created by and for American Indians. Low cost tuition for certificate programs to master degree programs. Info at aihec.org. Support provided by BNSF Railway. BNSF is proud to be a gold-level memorial donor for the creation of the National Native American Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. More at americanindian.si.edu.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
The leadership of the Afghan Taliban resistance are in Russia to investigate possible peace talks with the United States. They are there at the invitation of the Russians, who are hoping to reinitiate peace talks 17 years after the U.S. invaded Afghanistan after falsely blaming the government there for the 9/11 attacks on U.S. soil. The possible talks come after a dramatic march across Afghanistan by Afghan citizens weary of the invasion and the war. It is the first time in years that the Taliban have appeared in the same room with officials from the U.S.-supported Kabul government and with the U.S. also in attendance. Afghan High Peace Council delegates, which do not represent either party, were also present. The Taliban officials stressed they would only engage in direct talks with the United States when China, Pakistan, Iran, India, and Central Asian states have also sent delegates to the meeting.
Now that Louisiana has overturned its non-unanimous jury law, Oregon is left as the only state in the nation that still allows non-unanimous juries to convict people of felonies. In conjunction with the KBOO Evening News and the Oregon News Service, Aiden Moyer has more.
With Tuesday's elections now in the books, Oregon has become the only state in the country that allows non-unanimous juries in felony trials. Voters in Louisiana have passed an amendment banning the law that originated in the Jim Crow era, allowing convictions even when one or two jurors disagree. Nicole Lewis, a reporter with the criminal justice-focused news outlet The Marshall Project, says a felony conviction often sends a person to prison for a long time, and so the bar for proving someone guilty is beyond a reasonable doubt should be set high enough that everyone on the jury agrees.
To have a split jury, it basically renders that perspective or that opinion totally null and obsolete. Whereas in many other states with unanimous juries, it could result in a hung jury and you would get a retrial and just more opportunity to present a solid case.
This year, two people in Oregon have been exonerated after being convicted by a non-unanimous jury. Unlike in Louisiana before it banned its law, however, a unanimous decision is still required in murder cases. Lewis says Oregon's law allowing non-unanimous decisions originally was passed in 1934 after a trial in which one juror kept a Jewish man from being convicted of murder. He was instead convicted of manslaughter. The trial unleashed anti-Semitic and anti-immigrant sentiments and paved the way for the law. But Lewis notes the exoneration of two men this year has put momentum behind changing this law.
It's possible that just like in Louisiana, residents will take it upon themselves and say, well, if Louisiana did it, we could also try to get this issue on the 2020 ballot and have our chance to say whether or not we believe the practice of having non-unanimous juries should be continued.
Last month, the Oregon Court of Appeals heard arguments contesting split decision cases. State lawmakers expect the law to come up in the 2019 legislative session. In conjunction with the Oregon News Service and KBOO Evening News, I'm Aiden Moyer.
On Friday, the U.S. president signed a proclamation suspending entry at the U.S. southern border for 90 days. Critics say the proclamation is another attempt to discourage the Honduran caravan carrying asylum seekers, refugees, and migrants from continuing towards the United States. Currently, the caravan is in Mexico. To provide aid for the thousands of migrants, the government in Mexico City converted a local stadium into a functioning refugee camp with medics, food, and other donated supplies. Some members of the caravan and human rights advocates, like the ACLU, have already taken measures against the U.S. government by filing a lawsuit claiming the president, quote, continues to abuse the law, including constitutional rights, to deter Central Americans from exercising their lawful right to seek asylum in the United States, end quote. The U.S. president has repeatedly threatened to close the U.S. southern border, to cut off funding to Mexico, and most recently has threatened to scrap the new free trade agreement with Mexico, which would further destabilize Mexico's economy. Honduran refugees are escaping rampant violence, corrupt government officials, blackmail by gangs and police, and by blackmail by gangs and police. Central American nations have some of the world's highest homicide rates and lowest employment and education rates.
$15 million in Qatari cash was paid to Palestinian civil servants on Friday to cover their unpaid wages. The bailout is a partial response to the weekly Palestinian protests at the Gaza-Israel border against the Israeli occupation of Gaza and the West Bank, poor living conditions caused by war and a trade blockade, and the protests are also a call for the Palestinian right of return to ancestral land. The Israeli military has killed approximately 200 Palestinians since protests began in March. On Friday morning, Palestinian civil servants gathered at designated post offices and Hamas-affiliated banks to receive the promised cash in lump sums, which was supposed to cover 60% of their unpaid wages.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 9th, 2018. Here are the main points again. California wildfires kill five. The midterm election results are still pending in Georgia and Florida, and the Taliban are talking in Russia. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Joe Meyer, Tammy Habietas, Lucas Campbell, and Teresa Mitchell. The producer is Rachel Hartley, and our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. The director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to the KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson-Osterland.
And I'm Jasmine Moneymaker. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour burrows down to the roots of the greatest issues of our time. At 10, on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein talks to 350 PDX and Stopped Frack Gas PDX about the Portland Business Alliance and their opposition to good environmental policy. At 11, Health Watch brings you information to make you healthier. And at 11:30, Making Contact travels to Puerto Rico to focus on the quiet revolution that's grown out of resistance to austerity. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
And good night to you.
You are tuned into KBOO Community Radio. Coming up next is Counterspin. But first, we'd like to thank all of you who are our members and are supporting your evening news and your community radio station. Not a member? Guess what? You don't have to wait till our next drive. You can just go online to kboo.fm and click on that FM or on that donate button right at the top of our page and become an active listener, become an active member of your community radio station today. And guess what, Counterspin fans? It's your time.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Safia Wazir fled Taliban rule in Afghanistan as a child and lived in a refugee camp in Uzbekistan for 10 years. As of Tuesday, she's in the state legislature of New Hampshire. Ilhan Omar left Somalia when she was 8 and lived for years in a refugee camp in Kenya before coming to the U.S. She's now an elected congressperson from Minnesota. U.S. government changed last Tuesday. The House added its youngest woman, New York's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and two Native American women, Deb Haaland and Sharice Davids, two Muslim women, Omar and Rashida Tlaib, the first Latinas from Texas, Sylvia Garcia and Veronica Escobar, and the first lesbian mother, Angie Craig, in Minnesota. Ayanna Pressley is the first Black woman Massachusetts has sent to Congress. Johanna Hayes, the first Connecticut has. So there's a lot to think about in terms of who won in the 2018 midterms, but there's also a lot to think about in terms of how we locate electoral politics in our efforts to change the world. As Phyllis Bennis and Reverend William Barber wrote, quote, "Elections are not how we change history, but they are a big part of how we, social movements, poor and disenfranchised and marginalized people, communities of color, engage with power," close quote. So, Tuesdays in November and what happens every other day of the year is our topic today. We'll hear from Nagin Oliayi, inequality editor and researcher at the Institute for Policy Studies, and from civil rights attorney Liz O'Young of the New York Immigration Coalition about the fight over the 2020 census, which if you don't know just how that relates to elections, well, you certainly should. Going forward after the midterms, this week on Counterspin. But first, a super quick look back at recent press. NBC News' headline, Midterms 2018, Voters Brave Long Lines to Cast Ballots. That sort of suggests a feel-good story about people's dogged commitment to democracy. But in reality, long lines are a sign of dysfunctional democracy, where votes are suppressed due to inadequate equipment and missing equipment and machines that switch votes and hours that are unhelpful for working people and polling places inaccessible to disabled people. As with every election, corporate media focused overwhelmingly on horse races, very meaningful, without doubt, but to the detriment of all of the other things elections push to the surface, including, preeminently, their insufficiency to fully capture the public's voice. 51% of the electorate did not vote in this most recent election. Journalism truly invested in democracy would be very busy figuring out why that happens and what it means. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The midterms are over, well, possibly not in a couple of places, and they involved some historic gains for diversity in Congress, though Republicans did bolster their strength in the Senate. But not all of the attention was on individuals running for office. Voters around the country also made choices about a range of ballot initiatives that can have major impact in their communities. Nagin Oliayi is an inequality editor and researcher at the Institute for Policy Studies. She joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Nagin Oliayi.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, I did want to talk about some of the kind of down ballot stuff, but I first wanted to just get your overall sense of these midterm elections in terms of the inequality issues that you track. Some of the winners were people who don't hesitate to use the word inequality, you know, and that seems good. What's your overall sense of the election's effect on that set of issues?
Yeah, I think we're still going to see how this story plays out over the course of the next couple of years. We've seen some really great games in some people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ilhan Omar. At the same time, we need to see how that translates into actual policies that help working people and make sure that we hold the wealthy accountable. So it's, I think, a little bit early to tell. But I also just like to emphasize that I think a lot of these people who are focusing on inequality issues are playing a really long game, and it's working out. One of the things that I'd like to point to is the fact that, you know, voter suppression in states like Georgia and Florida is really impacting how politics is being played there. And so it's time for us to take that seriously as an issue. And one of the ballot initiatives that you mentioned in Florida, I think, will really do some work in making sure that people actually have a say in their own government.
Yeah, that's Amendment 4. Why don't you tell listeners who may not know what was so exciting about that and what that could mean?
I'm really excited about Amendment 4. It's in my home state of Florida. And basically what it's doing, it's repealing a Jim Crow era disenfranchisement law. The amendment got 64% of the vote in Florida, which is kind of, you know, shocking for people who are not familiar with the state, besides the fact that it comes up every few years in terms of recounts and, you know, being a swing state. But what it does is it'll restore access to voting rights to as many as 1.5 million people who have been convicted of felonies. And so that's a huge expansion in voting rights in the state.
You might even say Florida has artificially been kept a swing state by means of voter suppression that tamps down so many votes. And, you know, I think Amendment 4 was a great example of folks looking at an election and not talking about really personalities at all or who has a nicer smile or anything like that. You know, folks, I think, are ready to address issues in elections. And that, I think, is one of the more hopeful things, I guess, that I see.
Yeah, and I just want to say, too, on Amendment 4 in Florida, it's a long-time grassroots organizing effort that made that happen. You know, it's not something that started yesterday. It's something that's been in the works for some time, and I'm just really thrilled for all the people, the returning citizens who have worked on this, who are seeing their organizing pay off. So, again, yeah, it's something that is really deeply dependent on an issue. It's going to make a huge change for the electoral politics in terms of electing, you know, congressmen and governors and everything as well. But at the same time, it's something that appeals to the heart of fairness for Floridians.
Well, once we come out of elections, you know, there's a lot of horse race interest, and it's a lot of it's justified. But some of us focus more on the process itself and how representative actually is it, you know, and that's why things like Amendment 4 re-enfranchising felons in Florida, I think, is so important for folks who think that way. Well, another sort of general question. You had noted that in the last midterms in 2014, the Americans most likely to vote were those making more than $150,000 a year. And that obviously has some kind of impact. Do you see anything changing with that gap this time?
Well, it's a little bit too early to kind of make strong assumptions on those numbers just yet. But one thing that we did see was a huge turnout in the youth vote, which I think is going to make a huge difference. And I'd also like to point out some of the ballot initiatives that I think show what you can do to bring out working people to the polls. And that's two initiatives, particularly in Arkansas and Missouri. Voters in both states basically gave a raise to 1 million workers once you actually factor in everything. But they voted to raise the minimum wage in Arkansas and Missouri. In Missouri, they overturned a right-to-work amendment just earlier this year. And so when you ask people about the issues, they're really clear. You know, they want policies that are going to help working people, and they'll come after those.
And to the extent that candidates talk about them, that can, you know, engage communities. Well, again, elections are about what happens afterwards and holding people accountable, you know, for promises that they've made. So are there other sort of down ballot things that you were looking at around the country in terms of inequality and, you know, that did or did not pan out or even other races? I mean, I'm, of course, Kris Kobach, a big vote suppressor losing in Kansas is meaningful, you know. So in terms of following the issue of inequality, were there other things in the landscape that you saw?
Yeah, I think in the Kansas race, you can see how just disastrous tax policies that have affected people in the state of Kansas for years now. People were really surprised by this race, but if you look at what the grassroots organizing that's been going on in Kansas, people talking about repealing tax measures, you know, that's been going on when the Republican push tax bill is going through Congress in 2017, for example, people in Kansas were coming out and saying, we don't want these policies in our own state. The federal government should not be adopting them, you know, on a national level. We'll see a slow repudiation of these ideas that in order to help working people, you need to lower taxes and lower corporate taxes. So I think that's definitely coming through in this election. And like I said, it's a long game. You know, it's not necessarily something that's going to change tomorrow. These are movements that we're talking about. It's not, you know, one race. It's about interacting with power.
Well, I feel the loss of local media here, you know, because a lot of the exciting things are happening at the state level, at the community level, you know, in state legislatures, for example. And big corporate media tend to focus mainly on the top of the ballot. And a lot of interest and organizing and change is happening below that. You know, do you have any thoughts about how media could help or could stop hurting on issues you care about?
I'd like to point to some races in California where the media really made an impact. California had a series of different propositions on a state level and on city level to address the housing and homelessness crisis. That, I mean, the UN came out with a report just last week saying that the treatment of homeless people in San Francisco is inhumane. It's a human rights violation. And so this is something that's really on the top of the minds of people who are living in California. And there's two things that I think show why we need the media to be looking at this. One of them is Proposition 10, which was blocked with the help of moneyed interests in California. And what that would have done, it would allow cities to impose their own rent control policies. Right now, the state as a whole is that the cities can't do that. It was targeted by private equity companies that are also acting as mass landlords in California. And one thing they did was, for example, Blackstone, which California's state teachers' pensions are invested in Blackstone, they were using that money to go against Proposition 10, which would have helped teachers in the state. So more attention to that earlier on, I think, would have been very important. But then on the flip side, you can see in San Francisco, they did pass Proposition C. And what that's going to do is it's going to raise taxes on businesses that have revenues greater than $50 million. And it got a lot of national attention. And that happened because basically a fight between two billionaires, Jack Dorsey and of Twitter and Square fame, and then Mark Benioff, who's the Salesforce CEO, who was really outspoken in support of Proposition C. And so it's not even necessarily the fact that you had this crisis of homelessness that's getting the attention of the media there. It was actually the fact that you had two billionaires kind of squaring off against each other to talk about whether or not this tax was appropriate. In terms of accountability, you know, this is one of those things where this tax has the ability to make sure that the tech companies that are profiting off of San Francisco are making sure that they're giving back to their communities as well.
Well, I thank you for highlighting that ground-level work. I don't mean to be Pollyanna, but I do think that more information can mean more hope. You know, elections are crucial, of course, but not everything lives or dies by them. And a lot of work goes on, you know, on all those days that are not Tuesdays in November.
Absolutely. It shouldn't take billionaires to bring attention to the fact that there's a homelessness crisis and that there's a way to resolve it. So, yeah, I completely agree with you. The more information we can get about these ballot initiatives, the better as well.
We've been speaking with Nagin Oliayi. She is an inequality editor and researcher at the Institute for Policy Studies. You can find their work online at ips-dc.org. Nagin Oliayi, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
Van Newkirk at The Atlantic writes, quote, "White nationalist groups decrying white genocide and fearing demographic shifts, anti-immigrant populism, the long reach of old Jim Crow, and plain old backroom political strategizing all come together here at the unlikely nexus of the census, because the census at its core is the key to democracy," close quote. Well, we're not accustomed to thinking of the 10-year survey as crucial in shaping our day-to-day lives. But if it weren't, it's unlikely that it would be being debated in federal court as it is right now. So what's going on? Liz O'Young is a longtime civil rights attorney and advocate and a consultant to the New York Immigration Coalition. She's also adjunct professor at Columbia University's Institute for the Study of Human Rights and New York University's College of Arts and Science. She joins us now by phone from here in town. Welcome to Counterspin, Liz O'Young.
Thank you very much. Thank you for including me.
Well, we won't assume that listeners know the fundamentals. It may have been a long time since civics class, and it's also not like we talk about the census very much. So what is the relationship between this survey and elections like last Tuesday? Why is the census so important in the democratic project?
As you said, Janine, I can't underscore enough how the census means power and is the core of democracy, because it's based on the census results that redistricts are drawn. And as we saw, the importance of the Electoral College in the 2016 election, electoral votes are also distributed to different states according to census and population tallies. So it is absolutely critical. And the census, in addition to redistricting and the distribution of electoral votes, is so critical because $800 billion a year are distributed according to the census for the next 10 years. And so if you think about if you have a child that's age 5,
critical services that they may need the next 10 years, whether it's good roads to get to their school, whether it's certain health benefits, educational, and other types of services, where their hospital is located in their neighborhood, et cetera, is based on census results.
So why, then, is the New York Immigration Coalition in federal court, along with states and municipalities and other advocacy groups, why are you in federal court right now?
The current administration chose, at the last minute, to add a citizenship question to the decennial census. This will be a chilling factor on participation, especially given the last year and a half of unrelenting immigrant bashing by the highest office in this country. If there is a chilling factor like the citizenship question, certain people will not come out and complete that census. If they don't come and complete it, there will be an undercount. And that undercount is going to affect this whole nation, because every valid survey that's done always compares their results with the census. Businesses rely on census data as to where they employ their resources, to areas where populations have grown, jobs, etc., are dependent upon the census. And so if there is an inaccurate census because there's an undercount, that means the data will not be reliable. And it's based on that data that $800 billion a year is distributed across the country. We feel that the census is supposed to be nonpartisan. It's one of the few things that we as a nation can come together and do together to unify us. We need a count. It's a count of all persons living in the United States. And it's the 2020 census has been polarized. It has been politicized by the current administration. And that really puts the integrity, the credibility, the reliability of the census at stake.
Well, I would point out that people who work with polls, like the Roper Center at Cornell University, are upset about adding a question that asks, are you a citizen? Because they recognize that chilling effect that you're talking about. It's not really murky. There's every reason to imagine that if you ask a question about citizenship, that some people will not respond. And so folks who rely on polls, you know, are saying, well, that won't be real data. You know, we won't get actual information. And I just would underscore for folks that, as far as I understand it, the courts have said over the years that redistricting and congressional appointments should be based on population and not on citizen population, right?
That's correct. And Jeanne, not only experts in the field, but six prior census directors, Republican and Democrat, have advised the current administration, don't do it. Don't add this question. And they have gone ahead and done it anyway. And so I think that's pretty telling. And what's really about to hopefully come out in the trial soon is Secretary Ross of the Commerce Department, which oversees the census, has given inconsistent statements under oath as to his intentions as to why he put this citizenship question on there. The court trial right now that's going on is a consolidation of two cases, one by the New York Attorney General's office on behalf of 18 states. The other one was filed by ACLU, in which nonprofit groups are the plaintiffs, including New York Immigration Coalition, Make the Vote, et cetera. And the nonprofit organization's lawsuit, in addition to the claims raised by the New York Attorney General's office, has brought a claim for intentional discrimination, that our government has added this question deliberately to chill immigrant participation and to draw districts that favor Republican districts.
Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, as you've just said, He claimed to a congressional hearing that he was asked by the Justice Department to add this citizenship question, but then emails revealed that, in fact, he, in consultation with Steve Bannon and Chris Kobach, of all folks, sought to actually reintroduce that question himself. And it does matter. I think the way media carve things up is like there's a partisan thing happening at this top level, and then we're down in the neighborhoods. But of course, when people with clipboards show up at your door, it matters very much what sort of government they are seen as representing. And I don't think anyone would question that this is a White House that has made clear that they don't like non-white immigrants, documented, undocumented, naturalized, it doesn't matter. And that will translate to census takers.
Absolutely. And that has been raised in the trial so far, in the sense that the Census Bureau itself recognizes that a citizenship question is, quote unquote, a sensitive question. And Census Bureau's own research has shown that a citizenship question will decrease self-response rates. The difference that this trial is going to bear out hinges on whether or not the federal government's non-response follow-up plan to people who don't complete the census is an accurate substitute and an adequate substitute. So far, New York Attorney Generals and ACLU witnesses that have gone forward so far are unanimous and feel that the federal government's efforts to deal with non-response is not adequate. You need someone who understands the community, who has the trust of the community, who has cultural competence, deal particularly with hard-to-count communities, and Census Bureau's having a difficult time recruiting those enumerators. And one of those issues is this administration is trying to do. Secondly, the Census Bureau is not allowing people who are green card holders, who are lawful permanent residents, to serve as enumerators. And in a city, for instance, like New York City, where you have so many different languages spoken, it is often people who are green card holders who have the ability to go from English to a non-English language and go back and translate from a non-English language back to English. And they're not allowed in the 2020 census to apply for the enumerator position. And so that is a barrier right there. In addition, other plans that the federal government has to deal with the expected decline in response rates because of adding the citizenship question are woefully inefficient. One is to go to proxies like a landlord. Well, landlords may not be forthcoming of who lives in their apartment. Then they said they're going to use administrative records. Well, certain administrative records represent certain segments of our community better than others. For instance, if they use the city's financial records and taxes and so forth, certain groups may not be as well represented on those administrative records. They've tried to test it out, and in different parts of the city, there's been a 20% error rate. So, for instance, the administrative record may say that this housing unit is vacant, but when they went out, there were people living there. So there clearly needs to be more pre-testing with respect to the use of administrative records. The last thing that the federal government is planning to use is to help substitute for the self-response decline is imputation. That means look at other people in the neighborhood based on what their social demographics are, you impute that to the household that you weren't able to get information from. While in New York City, where you have many neighborhoods where there are multiple ethnicities and races, using the imputation is best used when you have homogeneity in a neighborhood. But if you have a lot of diversity in a neighborhood, that imputation is often going to lead to false positives. And so that's why it's critical that on the decennial census, when you only have like 10 or 11 questions, that you not have a question in there that's going to chill participation, because you want people to self-respond, because self-responses is the most accurate data.
Well, and so it sounds like a you know, dry diagnostic question, but in fact, it's a really real, live, living question where getting it wrong is gonna harm some people. You know, is gonna punch in a particular direction, and I guess that's what folks are seeing.
Correct.
Well, what happens if federal courts decide that Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross was within his power to add this question and they ignore the skullduggery behind it and it goes in? What kind of work will we need to do then?
We are optimistic that this question will be removed from the census. So far, all the evidence has pointed to its removal. Government's own research points to its removal, and we are optimistic that this will be removed. The government has not followed its own vetting procedures for putting a question on the census. They began, you know, way back as far as 2016 to begin to pretest these questions. The citizenship question has not been pretested. The one pretest that they did of the questions was in spring of this year in Rhode Island, and the citizenship question was not on there. There is glaring evidence that they have not followed their own procedures, and so I think we have a strong case, and we are optimistic that this question will. That this question will be removed from the census. So far, all the evidence has pointed to its removal. Government's own research points to its removal, and we are optimistic that this will be removed. The government has not followed its own vetting procedures for putting a question on the census. They began, you know, way back as far as 2016 to begin to pretest these questions. The citizenship question has not been pretested. The one pretest that they did of the questions was in spring of this year in Rhode Island, and the citizenship question was not on there. There is glaring evidence that they have not followed their own procedures, and so I think we have a strong case, and we are optimistic that this question will be removed from the 2020 census.
All right, then. We've been speaking with Liz O'Young, civil rights attorney and advocate and consultant to the New York Immigration Coalition, also adjunct professor at Columbia University's Institute for the Study of Human Rights and NYU's College of Arts and Science. Liz O'Young, thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You are tuned into KBO Portland. The time is 5:59 and 37 seconds right there on the dot. Coming up next, we got Deep Threes. What do we got coming up? Rachel says it's the Deep Threes, and we got an hour of music coming up for you. Brent Rose is taking an evening off tonight, so stay tuned for that. And make sure, if you're not a member of KBOO, go on to kboo.fm and click on that donate button right now. Right now.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.